This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have for you a Best of Reporters Roundtable today, beginning with Bill Dolan. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out here. Since we are speaking live at the noon hour, that means it's lunchtime for some people, and maybe so for the folks that are ensconced in the Lake County Jail and the criminal justice system. And I guess speaking of food, some changes are going to be coming to the meal service that's going to be offered up for some folks that are locked up. Tell us about that.
We have around 850 adult and several dozen juvenile inmates at the Lake County Jail and Juvenile Detention Center, respectively. And they have to be fed, obviously. And what we've done for many years is essentially buy groceries. When I say we, I mean county government.
Right.
And they employ about 14 cooks, and it all costs around $1.9 million a year to do this. And they always try to get competing bidding for groceries, dairy products, bread, what have you.
Right.
But they can't. The same suppliers provide every year, and the Lake County Board of Commissioners who do the purchasing feel that they can get it cheaper by bringing in a vendor. They did this last year. There's a Pennsylvania-based firm called Aramark that does concessions vending for across the country.
Yeah.
for a wide variety of government agencies, and they took over the task of feeding about 170 inmates in the Lake County Community Corrections Center. It's a state-financed alternative to state prison that's operated in Crown Point. And the director there, Kelly Bidorf, says that they've been in there for about 6 months now, and they've cut the food budget in half.
Oh, really?
They provide the food. They serve it. From soup to nuts, the whole operation, and they have a 2-year contract with them that'll be half the price of what they pay for the old traditional system.
Now, how does it seem to shape up now with this this new arrangement that's going to happen in the jail and in the juvenile detention center? And so we have four vendors, I guess, that are coming in to do different parts of the service there for the $788,000 or so that in the contracts.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Clovercrest Dairy, 5G's Distributing, ShopRite, and U.S. Foods essentially provide produce, meat, bread, and dairy products that the kitchens in the jail and the juvenile center use throughout the year. But starting the commissioners accepted those bids, but they said starting next year they'd like to bring in a vendor, somewhat like Aramark, to take over the jail and the juvenile center, just as they've done at the correction center, and cut the costs of having to feed all these inmates.
Well, it just sounds like that might be a good idea, at least to see if it's going to work. And they'll have some kind of benchmark because they've already established it with part of the criminal justice system already. Huh?
Well, the community corrections has been working seamlessly, according to Kelly Bidorf.
Yeah.
They had been in there before when there was a temporary emergency and performed well. And so she was confident that they would do so again. And 6 months into it, she said it's gone well.
That's great. One of the other stories that you had out there was a very interesting story. And if you haven't seen it online yet, you should check it out or see it in print as well. It's a chance to find out a little bit more about Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez. And you had a chance chance to go along, I guess, for a traffic stop, I understand, as he was traveling, I guess. I don't know if he was on his just on a regular traffic rounds or if he was on his way into work or what.
Well, we spent about between 2 and 3 hours with Sheriff Martinez, myself and John Watkins, our photographer, who also did a video. And Sheriff Martinez told us within weeks of taking office last fall that he still enjoyed getting out on the road. And sometimes he just wants to get away from the desk, and he'll get out there and do some patrol like he did for the previous 25 years he's been on the force. And we asked for and got permission to ride along with him. We did so about a week ago, and we went down I-65 and across I-94, and we stopped about three vehicles. Verbal warnings, no action, no shootouts, but it gave a typical view of. The sheriff kind of flexing his road muscles, and apparently he enjoys doing that sometimes more than the administrative duties of being the top cop.
I would imagine so, because you can't not spend your life in law enforcement and feel that you can sit behind a desk and feel just as comfortable as you are if you're sitting behind the wheel of your cruiser, I suppose. You can certainly understand that, too. One of the other stories that you had recently is following up on the primary election from May 8th. And one of the topics that was the ongoing dispute, I guess, between two candidates for one of the seats on the Lake County Council, incumbent Eldon Strong and a challenger, his name is
Christian Jorgensen.
And you have the complete coverage on this, talking with people in the election board and all, and following along with the recount itself. We know how it's turned out here with the concession by the incumbent. Tell us about some of the information that you learned and what you witnessed in watching the recount.
Yeah, we had a spring primary May 8th, but it took a month to finally end the counting. Eldon Strong, who had been on the Lake County Council representing the 7th District, which is South County, had been on the council since 2012. He ran for re-election in May. He was challenged by Christian Jorgensen, an attorney and president of the St. John Town Council. And on election day, the vote total had Mr. Jorgensen winning by two votes, pretty narrow, 22-19 to 22-17. Well, Mr. Strong decided that he preferred a recount see if somebody made a mistake. After some movements in court, we finally had the recount commission. Court appointed three members, a Republican, a Democrat, and one of the mechanics for the election board, familiar with election machines, to go through the paper ballots, about 80 of them. Those are cast when voters don't think they're going to be in town on election day and can't come to an early voting site. They cast a paper ballot, fill it out, and mail it in. Many times these ballots are rejected. I shouldn't say many, but occasionally they're rejected because of some technical violation. It's very strict. It has to be signed and sealed a certain way. And sometimes if there is a violation like that, they'll discount the vote.
Right.
And Mr. Strong was looking for some violation that the regular election board may have missed when the vote was initially counted on election day, May 8th. It took the better part of a day to go through them all, and in the end, there was no change in the vote total. Now, he could have gone through the machine vote, but as the mechanic, James Oliver, said, there's never been a change when you retabulate the machine vote. It's done the same way as it's done on election day, and you always get the same result. So, Mr. Strong, the recount was on a Friday. He said that late Friday that he wanted to go through with the machine count, but by Sunday he had slept on it and decided that there would be no point in that, and mm-hmm. and conceded. So now Mr. Jorgensen is the Republican nominee.
Now we know now that I guess the real challenge is going to be for the Democratic Party organization to find a candidate to run up against Mr. Jorgensen.
If they can. The Democrats and Republicans both have until the end of this month, June 30th, to fill any ballot vacancies where no one filed in the regular period earlier this year. One of those, of course, would be a Democrat running in the 7th District. James Weezer, the Democratic County Chairman, said that he has been speaking with a gentleman who may consider it. He didn't want to say any more about it until that person makes up their mind. But it would be very tough for a Democrat to challenge in that district. It is resolutely Republican. It covers Crown Point, Cedar Lake, Lowell, Winfield, and a little bit of St. John, all heavily Republican areas, especially South County. It would be a very difficult. I don't think a Democrat has held that position in living memory. So it's a very daunting task for anybody who wants to take that one on from the Democratic side.
Well, I guess we'll just have to see if somebody is interested in running. And they have to spend a lot of time, obviously, in campaigning. And like I say, it's going to be an uphill battle, I would imagine, for whoever decides they'd like to run. But somebody, I'm sure, will make a decision. We'll find out if there is somebody on the ballot come the end of the month here who's going to be running up against Mr. Jorgensen, to be sure. Oh, by the way, too, I had a chance to Sharon Jackson had a chance to talk in more detail with Mr. Jorgensen. We're going to have that conversation coming up here on Regionally Speaking shortly. One last story I'd like to check with you on, Bill, that you had covered here is keeping track of what's happening not only in the courts, but also, again, a former member of the East Chicago City Council got in trouble and is now going to face some time in prison. Tell us about that.
Well, that involves former East Chicago City Councilman Robert Battle. Mr. Battle had been a city councilman for some years, but he led another life. Federal law enforcement said that he had been dealing in cocaine in Michigan for a number of years. He had been stopped on Interstate 94 coming from Michigan in September 23rd, 2015, and Mr. Battle agreed to be a confidential informant for federal law enforcement mm-hmm. To help them arrest others involved in drug trafficking. But when he had a meeting with another man, it ended in that man's death. The circumstances around it have been in dispute. Mr. Battle killed a man by the name of Raimundo Camarillo, also of East Chicago. Mm-hmm. Mr. Battle claimed it was in self-defense and that Mr. Camarillo had attacked him with a knife, but he dropped that self-defense argument this week and agreed to plead guilty to having killed Mr. Camarillo. He said that he had not planned to do so, but that he did kill him at a meeting in October of 2015, and so he has pled guilty to killing a man during a drug transaction. As part of his plea agreement with the federal government, he will be accepting a sentence of somewhere between 10 and 20 years that the exact sentence will be decided in September by Judge Philip Simon. And we'll have to wait this fall to find out how many years he served. But he's already been in pretrial detention for about 3 years.
Now, what's interesting I know about this is that about the time that he ran into these problems with these drug-related charges, and then, of course, also with the death of Mr. Camarillo, is that he was, I guess, in the election process as well, too. He was running unopposed, I guess, back in November 2015, and it was probably interesting that he would be reelected, I guess, while he was in jail.
Well, yes, 2015 was a municipal election year. He had won his spring primary. His arrest took place in September, and he was in custody in October. But East Chicago, of course, is very Democratic, and there was no Republican candidate opposed to him at the time. So all he had to do was vote for himself, and he was in office. Of course, he couldn't do that while in detention, but somebody voted for him, and
yes.
He was elected and, in fact, sworn in. While he was behind bars early the next year in 2016. Finally, the city council decided that they couldn't put up with a member who couldn't attend meetings because he was in jail, and they expelled him from the council. And of course, an election was held, and he's been replaced, and he's no longer a city councilman, and of course never will be. Felony conviction bars him from ever running for public office again.
That's right. That's right. Bill Dolan covers government stories, not only agency meetings and other related news, but in this case here, what happened with an East Chicago city councilman in the courts, and does it for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's continue on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio with an interesting story from a reporter who has taken the time to sort through the trials and tribulations of a family who had lived in Chicago, in a very tough neighborhood of Chicago, to Northwest Indiana. But unfortunately, they've kind of gotten out of the frying pan and into the fire, so to speak. And let's turn now to reporter Kayla Belsha, who works for the Chicago Reporter, which is an online publication, by the way. You can go on the Chicago Reporter's website and read this in more detail. She's an education reporter, and she tells us about thousands of black students who have left the Chicago area for other school districts over time, but unfortunately they have gotten into segregated school districts like the ones they had just left. Well, first off, Kayla, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
And tell us here about the trials and tribulations of the Saunders family.
Yes, the Saunders family, I met them because the mother, Latrice, she used to be a local school council president here in Chicago, was really well known, very outspoken against the 2013 mass closures that happened here, where Mayor Rahm Emanuel closed 49 elementary schools, the most that any city had closed in the nation, which is still the top number. And so I wanted to see what had happened to Latrice and her family, and so I called them up, and she's like, oh, we don't live in Chicago anymore. We moved to Gary. Actually, her husband told me that, and I was like, Gary, what happened? And so they kind of explained to me the whole process. After their school closed back in 2013, they had a really hard time finding another good school in their neighborhood. And that was like one thing on a very long list that they had been thinking about, you know, is it time for us to leave Chicago? Do we want to live here anymore? They felt the rent was getting really high. They couldn't afford anything more than a two-bedroom, and they had, seven people in their family, and so they were really squeezed in there. They didn't like how violent their neighborhood had become. In Austin, the year they left, 60 people were shot and killed or injured.
Wow.
So it was a dangerous place to live. There were drug dealers that were outside of their home, and they just wanted to get out. And so they chose Gary. And one of the big reasons there was because it was affordable, and they were able to buy a home there that they could never have afforded in Chicago. And so their house cost around $13,000. But, you know, what came with that was Gary schools.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you noted in the article that you can check out, too, if you like, is the interesting point here about the fact that, of course, the Chicago's public schools gained their population growth over the decades, and I guess what you could call was a reverse migration. where we've had families from the South come to Chicagoland, and that's been going on since the early 20th century, I guess. But now we have this reverse migration where people are moving out of Chicago to southern communities like Dallas and Atlanta. And in this case here, we have the move from not very far away from Chicago into northwest Indiana. You mentioned about the problems that they have discovered in the move. The Saunders family, I guess, discovered that they thought that the school district was going to be fine, but what is it that they've discovered here about the Gary Community School Corporation that's very interesting and at the same time very troubling?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they loved their school in Chicago, and I think they thought, you know, we'll just go to the neighborhood school and it'll be okay. And you know, Latrice doesn't think the schools are any better. Kenneth, who's her husband, he's not really sure kind of how he feels. He's kind of mixed feelings. But the kids, when I interviewed them, Brittany, she's in 10th grade, Ken is in 11th grade, you know, they told me a lot of things that they were concerned about their education. You know, we all know Gary is going through a state takeover right now. The emergency manager is trying to help clean up the finances. The district's been under-resourced for a really long time. They're competing to keep their kids from charter schools. So it's a really complicated situation. But, you know, the kids told me about the problem of having these long-term subs teaching them instead of real certified teachers. And it really upset them because they felt like their education was being shortchanged. Brittany wants to be a neurosurgeon, and she's like, what am I doing with this long-term sub who doesn't know biology? And she's trying to, like, teach me right out of a textbook that she's like, that's not quality education. And, you know, they've watched schools close around them. They left Chicago partly because of a closure, and they get to Gary, and they're having these same enrollment declines, and they're watching schools close, and there's an arts high school that's on the chopping block now in Gary, and the kids are thinking, you know, we're gonna have more kids coming in. We had a career center program close this year, so children came in from that high school. So they're just watching kind of this disruption happen over and over again. And, you know, going without textbooks in some cases, their younger sister has been sharing her textbooks. So they pointed out all these ways that they felt like the budget cuts and the declining enrollment were still continuing to affect them.
Mm-hmm. What have you found in talking with the Saunders family here and the problems that they've run into here and making the move from Chicago to northwest Indiana, to Gary in particular? How have other students in African-American neighborhoods like Austin that have been able to move out and try and find other places to live as well as to be educated, are they running into the same kinds of problems as Gary has?
Yeah, I mean, I think our big finding of our investigation was that you know, we found these 15,000 students who had left predominantly African-American, predominantly poor schools in Chicago, and about a third of them ended up back in high poverty, very segregated schools in the Illinois suburbs. Mm-hmm. So some kids certainly do, you know, make it to somewhere that's more integrated, better resourced, but a lot of them leave one situation and kind of go right back into a similar situation. And here in Illinois, we've been having a lot of problems with school funding equity, which I know has been a problem in Indiana too. And so when they go to these suburbs that are smaller, they don't have kind of the mass of kids to get the resources, super dependent on state aid, you know, they end up kind of being even more under-resourced. Some of these districts are getting, you know, even more shortchanged than Chicago has been from the state. So, they're just really under-resourced communities that people are moving to.
Now, have you had a chance to talk with anybody with the Gary Community School Corporation, either with people directly involved in helping educate the family members or other people that have come across a similar kind of problem?
Yes, I did. I talked with the principal at Westside Leadership Academy, who's been the principal there for about 5 years. And, you know, he told me, he's well aware of the sub problem. He says, you know, I've been trying to get a teacher in here, but no one applied. And how am I supposed to compete with districts that pay their teachers better than I do or that I can? What can I do if no one wants to work here? And, you know, he said he feels like they've done the best they can to make sure that the budget problem isn't affecting their classrooms. He was, like, pretty adamant that he felt like he'd been doing a lot to try to make Westside a better school, to really get teaching and learning up. But, you know, the kids told me that they didn't really feel like much had changed in the years that they'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things he pointed to, like, you know, trying to mentor these long-term subs, the kids were like, that's not cutting it. You know, that's not really improving the way that the sub is teaching me.
Well, I guess maybe we should probably ask the question, do we have any good news to report about the Saunders family here? Have they been able to improve their lot as dealing from the making of the move from Austin neighborhood to Gary, Indiana? Have they been able to help make improvements in the education as well as their own life and the home?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I talk with them, they do feel like the move was worth it for them. They think that, you know, having that house is really important to them, having a housing stability. In Chicago, research has shown that African-American students are kind of the most mobile. They move and transfer the most because it's tied very heavily to instability in housing. So once you have a stable home that you can live in, there's all these other things that brings with it. And so they knew that that was really important to them. They were able to start a business being German Shepherds, so they have this kind of new way that they're making money. And, you know, the kids, they're really smart and they're really kind of independent. They learned how to advocate for themselves really early on because of the school closures. Their mom used to take them to these protests, and so they have this mentality where it's, like, really important to stick up for their education. And so Brittany told me this great story where she wrote a letter to her principal with her classmates that was demanding, you know, find us a real science teacher. And she had all of her classmates sign it, like 60 of them.
Wow.
And she said that she felt like, you know, she was emboldened to do that because she'd watched her mom protesting these school closures. And she spoke out and said, you know, I think these closures are wrong. And I know that you're doing this in poor Black communities. And why are you doing that?
Mm-hmm.
So I do think, you know, she's been kind of become more independent because of this. And both of them are looking at colleges. They're getting ready to graduate. So, you know, I think they... We'll see what happens, but I don't think that their lot is totally, you know, down in the dumps there.
Well, it sounds like that they've done very well, I suppose, in the way they've been educated. They've picked up some other education that perhaps they might not have otherwise had they stayed in the Austin neighborhood in Chicago, to be sure. Kaylin Belsha is the education reporter for a publication which is online now called The Chicago Reporter. Used to be a print ad online, now just strictly online. Go on to the Chicago Reporter website. Check out the story that she has written about thousands of Black students who leave Chicago for what end up being other segregated school districts. Kaylin, thank you very much for being with us to talk about your story, and the best of luck with you, and I hope to hear about some more stories that you put out too.
Thank you, Chris.
Regionally speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday is now on, taking a look at education issues. And for that, we are turning to Carmen McCollum, who's education reporter for the Northwest Indiana Times. And thank you, as always, Carmen, for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start out first here talking about some good news from the Gary Community Schools, and in particular from the 21st Century Charter School in Gary. Raven Osborne is a teenager who's picked up her bachelor's degree again before she finished her high school diploma. And we have an interesting story to hear about her 1 year later. Go right ahead.
Yeah. A year later, young Raven is teaching in a classroom. She's working as a math and reading interventionist, which means that she takes children aside in small groups, and she works with them on math and reading, sort of tutoring them and helping them to get through the lessons that they may not have gotten through in the classroom. Now, not only does she work with those who might be a little bit behind, she'll also work with those who are a little bit ahead, and then she puts together lesson plans for both of those groups of students so that they can work at their own pace a little bit and sort of help the ones who are behind move forward.
Now, I understand that she kind of took it in stride when some of the students there at the school that she was working with as an interventionist didn't exactly like her method of teaching, I suppose, so to speak.
I don't know if they didn't like her method of teaching.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they realized that she was young. I'm not sure. And I think some of them, you know, little kids maybe challenged her a little bit. And she's learning how to work her way through that and put into effect her classroom management skills.
Now, tell us how the school administrators and fellow members of education team are working with her and helping her learn a little bit more, too, now that she's a new teacher, so to speak.
Yeah, she has a teacher mentor who helps her out quite a bit, and she also has other teachers who will come to her assistance as she is learning the ropes. She seems to be, and they say that she gets along well with the children and that she does very well on preparing lesson plans and putting those kinds of things together. She's just learning that whole classroom management and those skills.
Now we know that she's gotten her college degree, and of course she got her high school degree just, you know, this is about a year ago. What's plans for her as far as higher education is concerned?
She is planning to get her master's degree, and she's also planning to get her teacher's license. She's going to get and a lot of times when they hire a new teacher, that person who is new may come in on an emergency license.
Mm-hmm.
and then they give them time to get that teacher's license. She'll be working on that in the fall, and she'll also, as soon as she finishes that, and that should take her about a year, I'm not sure, a year and a half or something, somewhere in that line. And once she's finished with that, she does intend to get her master's degree. She wants to keep it in, she's interested in doing K through 8. She says she likes that K through 8 age level. She does not think she wants to go into the high school. Mm-hmm. She thinks she's maybe a little bit too close to their ages.
Well, that's probably true. She's only 19, you know, we have to give her, at least 19. She is certainly smart enough to understand that the, yes, it may not be quite time for her maturity-wise to make it into high school. That makes all the sense in the world.
And she will be 20 in August. Okay.
The Chicago School Board recently appointed a central high school principal as a new assistant superintendent. Fill us in about that administrative change, please.
East Chicago School Board met last week to make some changes and add to the administrative staff. Actually, Paige McNulty, who is the superintendent in East Chicago Schools, has been looking for an assistant superintendent for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Did not have anybody in place. And I believe that the Central High School principal, Shauna Finley, who was named assistant superintendent, has been with the district approximately 3 years. And Shauna was moved up from Central High School principal to the assistant superintendent for Paige McNulty in the East Chicago schools to replace Shauna over at East Chicago Central High School. They put in Dieta Wright, who was the principal at Block Middle School. And mind you, Dieta has been with the school district for more than 25 years. She taught at the high school for many, many years before she became the principal over at Central. All of these moves will take effect July 1st.
Now, I understand that the appointment for Dr. Finley wasn't rushed right through. It was very, very well thought out and apparently had little opposition. Tell us how that worked out.
Well, the vote on that, as I recall, was three yes, one no, and one abstention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe the reason for that is because while Dieta Wright is from the East Chicago area and has been there teaching, Shauna Finley is not. And some of the board members, maybe were a little bit unsure of promoting her to that assistant superintendent position. I think that what maybe swayed some of them is that she has brought in that junior ROTC program at East Chicago Central. She's working with Sergeant Richard Ligon, the retired military guy, and he has been helping her to get that in. It's going to take effect in the fall, and students, freshmen and sophomores, will be able to enroll in that junior ROTC program. In addition to that, I understand that she's gotten some really good grants at the high school, including a Lilly grant that they're able to use for the students. And one of the things that Dr. McNulty said to me was that they're hoping that she'll be able to bring that expertise into the central office in terms of getting grants and working with students and developing additional programs.
That's great to hear. Let me ask you too, Carmen, since you keep an eye on the East Chicago schools very closely, we know that it hasn't been all that many years ago that after Dr. McNulty became superintendent that she had a crisis of her own to deal with the unveiling of the information that showed that that the Calumet housing project was contaminated by lead, and in turn, of course, led to the closing of the public housing project, and it had a big effect on the school system. How is the Chicago schools dealing these days with the aftermath of all of that?
Well, they're still working through that, still hoping to gain more students. They probably lost around 500 students as a result, and that was because those students had to move out of the West Calumet area.
Mm-hmm.
They had to go into different homes, different cities, and et cetera, and they moved around East Chicago. But some of them had to leave altogether and had to enroll in different school districts. So that caused, of course, a loss of money. They were able to get some state assistance, and that helped them through this year because they were able to include the number of kids even though they weren't there, and they were able to do that because of a law passed by the legislature. Things are looking up for them. They're rated a C overall as a school district, so that's certainly good for them. They've been able to move up despite some of the challenges they've faced.
We're talking with Carmen McCollum, who's the education reporter for The Times. And one of the other stories that she had, rather an interesting feature, was dealing with some information coming out of a report from Washington on the state of local and national teacher shortages and what kind of impact this we've seen on a decline in teacher pay. Fill us in about that report and how Indiana and Northwest Indiana, for that matter, seems to rate.
Well, it's Indiana is near the bottom. Well, midway and close, still close to the bottom. They're not doing very well. Average pay in Indiana, according to the National Education Association, is about $54,000. Most schools in our area are not at $54,000. For example, Raven started as a new teacher. She started at $38,000. That's still considered low for our area. Many of our schools are starting right around somewhere between $38,000 and $41,000.
Well, I know, too, that the school districts are, of course, insisting that that new teachers get their master's as soon as they can.
Yeah.
And certainly that means, of course, extra expense because they'll have to go back to school and bear that expense as well, even though it will benefit them, obviously, fairly quickly once they get their degree. Still, it's money that has to be spent, so they've got to be sure that they can cover all their expenses, too, I imagine.
Yeah.
What else in the report that you noted in talking with some of the other school officials, in particular in the school town of Munster, they're keeping a close eye on the impact that all of these costs, as well as what the teacher benefits happen to be for this and trying to recover from this. Fill us in on what you learned from that.
Well, Munster is indeed keeping a close eye on everything and how things are going. Some of the Munster teachers, and particularly Ryan Ridgely, who is president of the union, is concerned about the pay and how it relates to the cost of insurance for teachers.
Mm-hmm.
He talks a lot about the fact that when you have to take out the amount of money that teachers are having to pay for a single plan or a family plan, it reduces the salary even further. So, for example, it costs a teacher who wants a family plan anywhere from $12,000 to $14,000
wow.
to pay for that, depending on which plan is chosen. And if you subtract that from the average teacher in Munster schools making about $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
The average teacher pay in Munster is about $50,000. And then you figure the range is $38,000 to $72,767. They're definitely losing money.
And we know, too, that because it's had an impact on teacher salaries as well as other expenses within the school districts, we're finding more of our Northwest Indiana school districts are having to ask the voters in their particular communities for extra assistance. The referenda have been coming pretty quickly here, and I know that you featured that in the report as well.
Yeah, the referendums are coming, and we can expect more coming this fall. Every school district has not voted on it. Every school board has not voted on it.
Mm-hmm.
So although I've talked to them, I don't want to mention it until they have made that vote and it's public. But there are several districts that are looking at referendums, which you'll see in November and in coming up next year in May.
I would imagine. Carmen McCollum covers education issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Carmen, as always, thank you for spending time with us today about this, and we'll be checking back in with you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and I'm Chris Nolte, and with us now is Doug Ross with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He works out of the office in Valparaiso, covering LaPorte counties and Porter County. In fact, some of the news we have to talk about is involving the city of Michigan City. And Doug, I understand that one of the big problems we've come up here is that they've discovered in Michigan City the same kinds of problems which have already happened in cities like East Chicago and sections of Hammond and Whiting. It's about lead contamination.
Right. And so what's happening in Michigan City is they've ruled out the water supply as the source of the contamination. So, you know, they've got tests for elevated blood levels for a number of children in the city. They've tested, you know, only a small percentage of them, but they've got these tests that show elevated blood levels, and they pretty well narrowed it down to lead paint. The city has really a lot of the housing is well old. I mean, there's something like a third of it, as I recall, was built prior to 1940, and something like 75% of the houses were built prior to 1980, and it wasn't until 1978 that the U.S. banned the use of lead in paint for, you know, people's homes and apartments, you know, things like that. So, you know, what they're worried about is that the lead paint is, you know, either creating dust that's on the windowsills or on the ground, and that it's getting into young children's mouths, because, you know, kids will put anything in their mouth,
yeah,
or they'll lick anything. You know,
that's
how
right.
it goes.
Well, and you're talking about problems that have been around for at least 30 years or longer, certainly. As you say, with the older housing stock in Michigan City, it's very possible it could have gone back into the 50s easily, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, what's happened over time, and they had a, I know it's been quite a while back now, but last Friday they had an expert from Rochester, New York, who's doing some consulting work with the city, and he told about how he bought this old house in I forget what city it was in New York where he was living, and you know, the paint was all cracked and peeling and whatnot, so he scraped it all, you know, picked up the big chunks to throw away and all that, but you know, the fact is, the simple act of scraping the paint on the outside of his house, a lot of that dust went into the ground.
Yeah.
And so it contaminates the soil. You go into the house, every time you open and close one of those windows with the old paint, they talk about friction points, but basically, you know, what it is, you know, you're abrading the sand is like sandpaper on the windowsill, you know, you're rubbing it up and down, and that creates the dust.
That's right.
And so these children are getting that. And it may not be at their own home, it may be at a babysitter's home or something like that, grandma's home. But, you know, the fact is these young children are dealing with that issue. So Michigan City is pretty much environmentally conscious, more than a lot of cities, I would say. And so they're really diving headfirst into this issue.
What's the city council going to be able to do now to try to start to deal with this?
Well, they started talking about it on Tuesday, and that's, you know, one of those meetings where they call it a workshop meeting, city council, school board, or whatever does a workshop meeting. So they start talking about this, but they don't really make any decisions until they're in their official meeting. So I'm not exactly sure what they're going to do, but it sounds like, you know, my take on it is I think they've got about 150 grants that they were going to put toward a federal grant that they didn't receive, as the local match to it. So I think they'll be able to use that local match to, you know, A, try to get kids tested, and then B, try to get some information out, more information than they've been doing already, and they've done a lot, frankly, to get people aware of the lead paint issue. I'm not sure yet whether they're going to adopt an ordinance that deals with inspection of rental properties, which seems to be where the majority of these are, is rentals. So I don't know if they're going to be able to pull that one off like Buffalo, New York did. That was the standard that they were looking at. But you know, certainly you're going to be hearing things about that.
Well, that's one of these stay tuned kind of situations here too, to find out what the Michigan City officials are going to do. And I know also too another story that you had out there, Doug, in print as well as online in the Times recently, again from Michigan City, was dealing about the question of minority hiring in city government and some projects before city government, and it got a little testy, I understand, at a couple of the town meetings recently. Tell us about that.
So I wasn't at the Board of Works meeting. Let's see, this would have been last week ago Monday.
Yeah.
But I was at the City Council meeting a week ago Tuesday, and it all boiled up there. So Michigan City has this ordinance that says at least 50% of the wages on any public works project for the city has to be Michigan City residents. One of the pastors, Damon Carnes, is on the Michigan City Redevelopment Commission, and he's ticked off that you know, white people in Michigan City can be hired for things like this, but you don't see a lot of minorities hired for these jobs. And so, the local hiring ordinance that Michigan City has doesn't really deal with the minority hiring because, as Mayor Ron Meir kind of was pretty testy about, he said, I'm very concerned about getting jobs for minority residents of Michigan City, and I think that the workforce should represent the demographics of the city. However, it's illegal to have an ordinance that says that you have a minority hiring quota. So he just wasn't going to, so he was trying to say, I agree with you, but we can't do it legally. And Pastor Carnes was still pretty upset about it. So it was an interesting council meeting for sure.
I would imagine. Do you get the impression from attending the meetings and hearing the conversations that Pastor Carnes is really just trying to bring up the point? And certainly this is coming at a time with the 50th anniversary of Reverend Martin Luther King's assassination and a lot of other issues which have come up here lately as well, and trying to bring equality to light in places where maybe it's need to be in light?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Pastor Carnes did fight the 50th anniversary of King's assassination by saying he took the time this year, as part of the 50th of Servants, to read the entire letter from Birmingham rather than just the highlights like mm-hmm. everybody else does.
Right.
And so he would do that. And noted that what King was saying is, you got to keep pushing, and frankly, make yourself a royal pain if you're going to accomplish anything. Just, trying to work within the system doesn't always work, was, I guess, the point of the letter.
Right.
And certainly how Pastor Carnes translated it. So, he was being aggressive. Now, the question is, what do you do? So there's, in Gary, there's this training area that's dedicated toward, and as I recall, this was something that Earlene Rogers pushed for when she cast the deciding vote that did the toll road privatization,
uh-huh.
if you remember that,
yeah.
Way back. And so that was her stipulation, that she got this built into the law so that they would create this, minority training thing to try to get more minorities into the construction trade union. And so, that's part of that. And we'll see how that plays out. But certainly that's a factor in trying to, frankly, just get more minorities into the union so that they can get these jobs.
We're talking with Doug Ross with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers news in Porter and LaPorte counties in the paper and online. And one of the other stories I know, Doug, that you had recently, a story in one of the weekend papers, dealt with the problems that the Porter County government is having in trying to get a revised 911 emergency communication system going in the community. And the idea being that there's some changes ahead, but some people don't like the way the changes are happening, and it may have brought up some interesting controversies. Tell us about your story.
Boy, it's a complex one. So basically the gist of it is Porter County has to convert to a digital radio system for dispatching, like, LaPorte County has already done that, and, Lake and so forth. And so, mm-hmm. It's something that they all have to do. So as part of this, there are a lot of moving parts. One of them is that they're moving the 911 dispatch center, Porter County Central Command, or Central Communications, I guess,
yeah.
is the name of it. They're mm-hmm. moving that into the old jail,
right,
in downtown Valpo. So the county bought back the old jail that it had given away to the city. The city sold it. The county wants office space again, so they bought the old jail. So they're putting the radio equipment in there, and they figure as long as we're doing it there, let's put the new stuff in, and this is going to be really high-tech, impressive stuff. So you'll be able to see you know, like the dispatcher will be able to see live video streaming of you know, where the 911 caller is and things like this. You know, pretty amazing things. And assuming there's a camera, right? But they'll be able to do all of these cool things. And in the process, they are telling Chesterton and Porter, who have their own dispatch center, they're saying, hey, why don't you complete the consolidation and join with us? You won't have to buy your own equipment to upgrade to be compatible with what the county has, and it won't cost your taxpayers a cent. So what happens now with the dispatch is a call comes into the Porter County Central Communications, which is at the police station on the very southern edge of Valparaiso on 49. They get all of the 911 calls in the county. And then if it's a police call to Chesterton or Porter, then they transfer that call back to this Doolin Communications Dispatch. I forget what it's called. But basically, they've got their own dispatchers. They've got two per shift working, and then they'll dispatch that. So you have a built-in lag time right away of, you know, taking a call, answering it, finding out, okay, here's what you need. Let me send it back to Chesterton and Porter. So, you know, the county officials are saying that is a serious issue, that lag time. And frankly, if you have a whole, you know, everything blows up in, well, not literally, but figuratively, in Chesterton or Porter, then you're going to have two really hairy dispatchers. Whereas if it went to the county one, then you've got all these cross-trained dispatchers that would be able to help.
Right.
So there's that. There's that issue. And then the other one that's really hot right now is how many is Porter County is changing the way that they're going to handle calls to, you know, for service. So if there's a call for fire or EMS, they'll have one channel that'll serve the whole county, and then they'll send the fire or EMS call to that channel. If there's one for police, minus Chesterton and Porter right now, but if there's one for police and it's an emergency, then they would send it out to one channel. Portage and some of the others want to have two channels. But here's how the county is trying to figure out. They're practicing this already, frankly, and have been for a few weeks now. They've been sending these silent dispatches that the way it works basically is each police officer has his own laptop in the car, right? And so if it's a non-emergency thing, you know, some traffic situation or something, they can send a message in text, and then it'll, you know, ding on the officer's laptop, and then when it's safe, you can check the, you know, don't crash into a car while you're
right.
Reading your text. But you know, when it's safe, read the message, and then you can respond that way. And so that is trying to drain all of the voice traffic that's non-emergency off of that emergency channel. So all of these things are going on. You know, the county is spending millions and millions of dollars to try to do this. And then naturally all these controversies are going to pop up.
Well, it sounds like it's just going to continue on until they get the new systems going and more people familiar with it. And in this case, the police departments in Portage and in Chesterton. So they'll come online, I guess, eventually, and the things will develop, and hopefully some of these bugs will get worked out. But in the meantime, it sounds like it's going to be an interesting story, to say the least, as they work out all the bugs of this problem then, I guess.
Yeah, stay tuned for sure.
That is right. That is right. Doug Ross is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana and an editor in the Porter County and LaPorte areas. And he's been covering the stories that we've been talking about here on Regionally Speaking today. As always, Doug, thank you for joining us, and we hope to have you back on again real soon.
Oh, it's a true honor. Thank you.
And thanks to our reporters, Bill Dolan, Carmen McCollum, and also from the Chicago Reporter, Kaylin Belsha, joining us today here on Regionally Speaking.